My name is Hope Todd, and I direct the Legal Ethics Program here at the DC Bar. And the Legal Ethics Program provides guidance to lawyers on the interpretation and application of the DC Rules of Professional Conduct. Let's start with the rule that really deals with lawyer advertising, communication, and solicitation. Because before we get to fee sharing, this is part and parcel of it. But we really have to start with how you are communicating, marketing, and advertising yourself. And the good news for the DC Bar member is, as Tom Mason likes to say, we have won the race to the bottom in terms of restrictions on lawyer advertising. We are a very liberal advertising state for lawyers. And the public policy behind that is that we want clients to be able to find lawyers. That has been deemed a higher value than sort of putting restrictions on lawyers, kind of judging subjectively whether something is tasteful or obnoxious. You know, we really don't get into that in the District of Columbia. We want three things. We want it to be truthful, not misleading, and capable of substantiation. If you can meet that standard, your advertising is fine with the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, and you are good to go in the District of Columbia. We have a leading ethics opinion. It's an oldie but goodie, dealing with lawyer advertising, applies to electronic advertising. This happened to be a Yellow Pages announcement, but the analysis is going to be the same if you're advertising on the internet. And it's ethics opinion 249. And again, all the ethics opinions are available on the bar's website. So the question is, if you specializes in, we're allowed to do that in DC, but how does that really work in the real world where everybody's advertising on the internet and it reaches into every jurisdiction? And this is, so the good news is you're a DC lawyer. The bad news is the internet is everywhere. If you're not licensed in another jurisdiction, and you are not reaching out and serving clients in other jurisdictions, then I'd say don't worry about it, because there's no reason why Maryland or Connecticut or California is going to waste their bar resources in coming after you, even though the people sitting watching TV in California can theoretically, you know, see your ad or go on the internet and see your ad. Where it becomes troubling and problematic, and where sometimes bar counsels will go after people, is if you advertise using our liberal rules and then you're picking up all these clients in Florida where they have crazy rules about lawyer advertising, then, you know, you might see a complaint saying, you know, you are providing legal services in Florida by your mere grabbing of our clients or trying to solicit them. So But to go back to the answer, yes, you are right. If you are licensed in three different jurisdictions and you are advertising and trying to get clients in all three, then you're going to have to comply with the least restrictive, with the most restrictive rule. So the question was, let's say you have a federal practice like immigration, you're only licensed in the District of Columbia, but you actually have the potential or are obtaining clients from other jurisdictions.
They live in
Maryland, yeah. They live in Virginia. I would be really careful.
Okay.
And I would try and comply with both Maryland and Virginia. And I'll just use an example. Maryland will disbar people that aren't licensed in Maryland. And they are actually very strict on their UPL. And they have some interesting interpretations about even federal practice and whether that constitutes UPL. I don't necessarily agree with those, but they, you know, I would make sure that you're complying. Virginia, on the other hand, they take a much more rational approach to that issue in particular, and they have an ethics opinion that deals something similar to that. So our unauthorized practice of law rule in the District of Columbia is written for physical where your butt sits location test. So where you are practicing law, if you are in the District of Columbia physically, that's how our UPL rule, unauthorized practice of law rule, that's how it reaches. But not every jurisdiction's unauthorized practice of law rule operates that way, and if they see you as reaching in and pulling out, that in some instances could constitute unauthorized practice. So you just need to be aware of, and if to the extent you can get advice from those individual jurisdictions, that's probably the most prudent way to go. So the first question in the quiz was, the DC rules permit a lawyer to state that the lawyer specializes in insurance law. Well, in DC you can say that you specialize in something if you specialize in something. You can't create unjustifiable expectations. So let's say that you have done 1,500 trials and you've won all 1,500 trials. You can't say, I've won 1,500 trials, therefore I'm going to win your case. You can't say that, because that could be the case that you lose. So there are some small limitations on this in terms of comparing yourselves to other lawyers, and those things are talked about in the comments. But as a general rule, we take a pretty liberal approach. Okay, same is true about lawyer solicitation. Generally, lawyers may solicit in person in the District of Columbia. And for those of you who are familiar with the model rules of professional conduct or also practice in model rule states, typically the model rules don't allow this, but DC does allow it. So the limitations on solicitation in the District of Columbia, again, can't be false or misleading. And really, they're the reasonable ones. You can't be coercing someone. You shouldn't be harassing someone. And if the client is in apparent physical or mental condition that would make it unlikely that they could exercise reasonable judgment, then that's going to be a problem. So what happened in 2007? So some of you who've been practicing in the District of Columbia for a long time know that DC used to have a rule that allowed lawyers to pay a flat fee to non-lawyer runners for bringing them business. This was the rule in the District of Columbia from 1991 until 2007. And it's kind of known as DC's grand failed experiment. Really, nobody else came on the bandwagon from around the country. And what we found were there were lots of complaints to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel because there was a lot of abuse surrounding this rule. And so in 2007, the DC Court of Appeals deleted what was formerly 7.1b5, which allowed the payment of a flat fee to non-lawyer runners. Here's the bad news for some of you. This is really the rule in the District of Columbia. There are no referral fees in the District of Columbia. Here's the rule. 7.1c, a lawyer shall not pay money or give anything of material value to a person other than the lawyer's partner or employee in exchange for recommending the lawyer's services, except, and we're going to go through all of these exceptions, but the general rule is there are no referral fees. What can you do? You may pay for advertising. That's the first part of the rule. Right there, pay the reasonable cost of advertisements or communications permitted by this rule. So per click, flat fees paid by a lawyer, those are all okay. You can pay for advertising. You may participate in a lawyer referral service and pay the usual and reasonable fees paid by the lawyer referral service. And there are two really good ethics opinions on this. If you're dealing with an internet lawyer referral service, you want to take a look at 342. And if you're dealing with a lawyer referral service that wants to share a percentage of your fee, you're going to want to take look at the most recent one. What else can you do? You can purchase a law practice. Now, we're not going to get into the nitty-gritty of Rule 117. It's an unusual circumstance. But if you ever find yourself in a position to want to buy a practice or part of a practice or sell yours, then you're going to want to be familiar with Rule 1.17. So what happened in 2007 is the rule got amended. And it was amended to say a lawyer should not give anything of value to a person other than a lawyer's partner or employee for recommending the lawyer's services through in-person contact. And then the comment explained that in-person includes telephone but not email. Well, then what happened? Well, lawyers found that language confusing. And the workaround really was electronic communications. And that was really not intended by the rule change. And there were also still questions about, well, does that mean we can't refer cases to one another and share fees and give referral fees? And there was just a lot of confusion around that rule. And so the Rules Review Committee went back and said, you know what, let's look at this again and see if we can't make this more clear. So they did. So here's the bad news for some of you. This is really the rule in the District of Columbia. There are no referral fees in the District of Columbia. Here's the rule. 7.1c, a lawyer shall not pay money or give anything of material value to a person other than the lawyer's partner or employee in exchange for recommending the lawyer's services, except, and we're going to go through all of these exceptions, but the general rule is there are no referral fees. What can you do? You may pay for advertising. That's the first part of the rule. Right there, pay the reasonable cost of advertisements or communications permitted by this rule. So per click, flat fees paid by a lawyer, those are all okay. You can pay for advertising. You may participate in a lawyer referral service and pay the usual and reasonable fees paid by the lawyer referral service. And there are two really good ethics opinions on this. If you're dealing with an internet lawyer referral service, you want to take a look at 342. And if you're dealing with a lawyer referral service that wants to share a percentage of your fee, you're going to want to take a look at the most recent one. What else can you do? You can purchase a law practice. Now, we're not going to get into the nitty-gritty of Rule 117. It's an unusual circumstance. But if you ever find yourself in a position to want to buy a practice or part of a practice or sell yours, then you're going to want to be familiar with Rule 1.17. And what else can you do? You can refer clients to another lawyer or a non-lawyer who refers clients to you, as long as the reciprocal agreement is not exclusive and the client is informed of the existence and nature of the agreement. So the other part of that is 1.7b4, which is a personal financial conflict of interest. So you're going to want to look at comment 36 to rule 1.7. So if you have this sort of reciprocal non-exclusive arrangement with another lawyer, you're going to want to make sure that you're making all the appropriate disclosures to the client about the nature of that relationship. But if you do that, then it's permissible. So this rule 7.1, which is the rule we've been talking about, lawyer communications, advertising, and solicitation, does not address fee splitting between two lawyers. Okay, fee sharing between two lawyers is not one lawyer paying another lawyer or one lawyer collecting money from another lawyer. It is the sharing of the fees that the client pays the lawyers. And that is an important distinction because that is the central, if you think about that central relationship, it really will help you to stay on the right track when you share fees because you really understand that you have a fiduciary relationship with the client. You are in some way providing a legal service to that client. And the rules of professional conduct that deal with your behavior in that relationship apply to you. We're going to be under the fee-sharing rule, which is 1.5e, when we're talking about sharing fees between lawyers. So what is DC Rule 1.5e? This is the rule that says you can do this. You can share fees from a client if you're not in the same law firm. And here's how you can do it. And we'll go through each of these separately, but I'll just run through them real quickly. You can do it in two ways. The division can be in proportion to the services rendered by each lawyer, or each lawyer can assume full responsibility for that representation. The client needs to be told in writing who are the lawyers who will participate and what are they each going to be responsible for, and then if there's any effect on the total fee charge, and in many cases there won't be, the lawyer would charge the same whether or not there were one or two of them, but the client needs to be aware of that. And then the client needs to give informed consent to the arrangement. And informed consent is a defined term in the rules of professional conduct. So if you go to the terminology, there are a few comments on it, and it really is telling the client what are the material risks and benefits to this relationship. And when you're sharing fees the way that the rules sort of envision fee sharing would happen, if you sort of go back historically, the purpose of allowing lawyers to share fees was so that lawyers would affiliate with expert lawyers, trial lawyers in many cases, when they did not have the full competency to undertake the full representation. But they were hesitant to farm any of it out because they didn't want to risk losing the fee. So what this rule says is we're not going to make you lose the fee. We're going to let you get the people involved who are going to best serve that client. And the client's going to be able to pay for those services. But you, lawyer, who've done a lot of work for this client, who think of this client as your client, aren't going to lose this client because you affiliate with somebody who has some extra expertise here. 1.5e, you can think of this prong as the no free lunch. Right, so the fee division can be in proportion to the services performed by the lawyer. So maybe the lawyer did the initial intake, did the investigation, may have even done some letter writing, but isn't going to take this to trial. But even there, so you can get paid for that section if you want. Or if you want to be paid more than that, then you have to take on joint responsibility for the representation. Now, I'd say in the vast majority of fee shares, it means that both lawyers remain ethically and financially responsible for the client for the entire matter. And we'll talk about a little bit what that means specifically. So here are the comments that sort of dive into this. So you can either do it again on proportion of the services rendered, or if they, all the lawyers who are participating, assume responsibility for the whole representation. If we do it on proportion of the services rendered, the fee has to still be reasonable, right? So you're paid for that which you add, the value that you added. If you do it by joint responsibility, it doesn't really matter how the lawyers between themselves decide that they're going to divide up the fee. That's actually a large, there's a huge amount of discretion in the DC rule. The model rule actually requires the lawyers to explain how that fee is going to be divided between the two of them under joint responsibility. Under our rule, we don't say that. You don't have to do that. I mean, I would always say it's a best practice to let the client know, but you don't have to. The client just needs to know what is their responsibility to these two lawyers. What's the difference between if I just hired one lawyer or hired both of you together, and who's going to be responsible for what? But ultimately, you don't have to put down there in writing exactly how you're going to divide up the fee if you go with the joint responsibility prong. But the joint responsibility prong has the other downside. You are on the hook. You are on the hook. And I have to tell you that I get a lot of calls on the helpline for people who think that, you know, I'm going to participate in this fee sharing and I'm not going to have anything really to do with it once I pass it off. And technically, the rule doesn't require you to do anything specifically. You don't have to review the pleadings if it goes into litigation. You don't have to, be in constant communication with the client. That's not going to be required. However, if that other lawyer drops dead tomorrow, you are on the hook. And so you really have to think about, both ethically and financially, you really have to think about whether or not it's worth it. In terms of your license, may seem worth it if it's a quick buck, but ultimately it may cost you in the long term. So these sorts of relationships should not be entered into lightly. And the comment even says, if the lawyer wishes to avoid such responsibility for the potential deficiencies of another lawyer, the matter must be referred to the other lawyer without retaining a right to participate in fees beyond those fees justified by the services actually rendered. So here we go. Ignorance is not bliss. Again, it doesn't require the referring lawyer to perform any minimum portion of the total legal services rendered. However, you can't escape the implications of joint responsibility by avoiding direct participation. Okay, and finally, you need to spell it out for the client. So there's no behind-the-scenes agreements with lawyers. If you're going to do a joint responsibility fee share where the client is paying and that money is being divided between lawyers, then you have to disclose that arrangement, who the lawyers are and what they're going to be responsible for, to the client. And there's at least one District of Columbia Court of Appeals case in Ray Bell where strict scrutiny was applied to this. You're just not going to want to hide things from your client. So what are some other practical considerations? How well do you know the lawyer who you're going to be sharing fees with? Do you have malpractice insurance? Does the other lawyer? And does your policy cover the malpractice of co-counsels of another firm? Now, these are all questions that you're going to want to put to your insurance company and probably to the lawyer who you're going to co-counsel with. Then sort of another issue that pops up sometimes that we get questions on the helpline deals with sort of after the fact, right? So you refer something to another lawyer, the client, you do everything right, the client pays, and now the other lawyer is responsible for paying you, and guess what? They don't pay you. Now this becomes a dispute between the lawyers. The client is out of this. They've paid there. So it's not a, it's not something that would go before the attorney-client fee arbitration board. It's really a dispute between lawyers. However, 1.15 still applies to the lawyer who collects the money from the client, because now you are in possession of money that arguably belongs to someone else. So you have to put that in a trust account. It's not your money. So 1.15A applies not only to client money, but also to third-party money. And if there is a dispute, 1.15D is the rule that's going to apply. And it says, if a dispute arises concerning the respective interests, then you got to put the undisputed, you know, you give out the undisputed portion, and you put the money that's in dispute in an escrow account. The last thing you want is to be disciplined for getting into a fee dispute with another lawyer. And unfortunately or fortunately or however you want to look at it, the rules surrounding trust accounts, as I'm sure you all know, it's like strict liability in the District of Columbia. It's the death penalty, so to speak, of the rules of professional conduct. So you're just going to want to be careful. That's not to say that you as the lawyer might disagree with and have a legitimate fee dispute with the other lawyer. But if you do, just make sure that you take that money that you're fighting about and put it in a trust account until either you can resolve the dispute or you can get a third party to resolve it for you. I mean, I do think that, as I mentioned before, Ethics Opinion 284 goes through some of that analysis. Is this really a contract attorney? Or the other opinion is Opinion 338, which is our of counsel opinion. So if you read those two opinions together, and then I would also recommend the considering of counsel, speaking of ethics column, that sort of gets into some of the distinctions between a contract lawyer who would then be considered part of your firm and not fall under 1.5E, and those lawyers who you're truly sharing the client's fee with, that we would need to meet the requirements of 1.5E. So the question there was, if you're two solos and you have a case and it's too much work and you want to hire the other solo to work on this case on a per hourly basis, does that fall under 1.5E or is it something else? I think in most cases it's something else, and it's addressed by Ethics Opinion 284. That's really a temporary contract lawyer, and it's not 1.5E because it's really no different than paying a big law firm paying an associate who's getting an hourly salary. I mean, unless that lawyer really is the lawyer who is, you know, who's doing all the work, and really what's going to happen is the lawyers are going to agree to percentages, and you know, it can't be a sham. I mean, if you're really going to pay this lawyer as a contract lawyer on an hourly basis to work on the case, that's completely legitimate, and we're not in 1.5E. The question is, how do I really assume liability for something that I don't necessarily have competence or expertise in, which is why the purpose of the rule is, and that's a really good question, and there's a technical answer for that. The liability under this rule is the liability that partners have to one another, and that's under Rule 5.1. And so it really has more to do with knowing that there are systems in place for competent and ethical behavior of the other individual, and also that you are held responsible for behavior that you knew about and did nothing to fix or basically condoned. So to some extent, that's part of the answer to the question. I think the other part of the answer is in how you present this to the client. So the rule itself says that you explain to the client who's going to be responsible for what. And I think it's an excellent idea to put the client on notice that the reason you're bringing this person in is because you don't have this expertise. And also to say to the client at that point, but if you ever have any questions, you are free to contact me or the other lawyer, and we are happy to have this discussion with you. And ideally, you have a good relationship with that person that you are effectively co-counseling with, even if you're not going to bring the patent stuff. You know, because where lawyers get into trouble is where they pass something off, they really don't want to have anything to do with it, they totally just, I'm going to la, 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 and then the client starts calling them and they don't respond to the phone calls or the emails, and they don't really take any responsibility for it, and all of a sudden there's a malpractice lawsuit. To the extent that you really need advice on a specific client matter or arrangement, I would recommend that you, after this session, give me a call. There are 3 ethics counsels in the legal ethics program, and our primary responsibility is to respond to inquiries from DC Bar members on questions that arise under the DC Rules of Professional Conduct.